It's a god-awful small affair to the girl with the mousy hair. But her mummy is yelling no, and her daddy has told her to go. But her friend is nowhere to be seen. Now she walks through her sunken dream to the seat with the clearest view, and she's hooked to the silver screen. But the film is a saddening bore, for she's lived it 10 times or more. She could spit in the eyes of fools as they ask her to focus on sailors fighting in the dance hall. Oh man, look
at those gay men go. Everybody.
Wait, it's
talking!
What are you guys out.
Well, folks, we are at another episode of What Are You Guys Talking About? And I pulled the big switcheroo on you. I think we said we were going to do Teddy, which we will still do. But we're not doing Teddy today. I went, and I think it was like the day after, or it was Thursday. I always go to movies on Thursday. So I went on Thursday to go see Licorice Pizza. And, I, you know, I'm not going to spoil it for you in the first sentence, but it may just be my favorite film of the year. So I called Ed. I texted Ed with some very capital letters and just said, you need to see this film. This is everything you always told me about. He thought I was crazy at the time. But then I assume we're doing this on the podcast. I said yes. And he's just seen it today.
Yes, I did. Very went good. To see it.
The only other thing to I want to go see it again, because this weekend, obviously, and I'm sorry, I was going to tell you I was doing all over the weekend. I haven't yet. But this weekend, we were at the Curzon, right? Because I was right down in the area. And they have, the front of the Curzon is dressed like it's been painted for Licorice Pizza.
Oh,
it's I awesome. Mean, it's amazing. I'm sure you could find it if you Googled what it looks like, but it makes me want to go to the Curzon and watch it again because it was that good. Do you know what I mean?
That's cool.
So anyway, we're going to be talking about why or that film, why I think it's a good film, why I think it's a film everybody needs to watch at this time. But welcome. If you haven't joined the show before, just in case you're like, who is this guy and who's talking to me? I am Mouth, or Jason, as most people call me, but some people call me Mouth. And this is Inanno, or Ed. We are two filmmakers. We have started LVP Studios, got a long time ago now, four or five years ago. And we use this podcast to kind of talk about, A, what the, you know, what stuff we're working on. So there are a couple episodes that talk about the projects that we're on. But mostly we talk about what we're watching and what's influencing us and what we're, you know, using as kind of our spurs for creativity. And, you know, if you've been listening to the show long enough, you realize we each have our own kind of tastes, things that we're into. But it's generally our take on a film or on a TV show or something like that. Sometimes we talk about the filmmaking aspects of it. Other times we're just so in awe of it that we never get to that. But it's a good ramble, and I hope you enjoy the generally about an hour and a half you'll spend with us today. Before I continue, though, just one thing I always handle at the beginning of the show is what I call brass tacks. And that's because I need to make sure you can understand where else you can get other episodes. So you are listening to us on SoundCloud. That is the primary spot where you can subscribe, share this with other people on SoundCloud, whatever else you want to do. We're also available on pretty much all the other podcasting platforms. I generally listen to us actually through Apple Podcasts. We're also on Spotify, Podbean, a lot of different ones. If there is one and you know you heard the show in one place and you want it somewhere else, I always tell people, just tell me and I'll drop it on the RSS feed. But if you want to get in touch with us, the best way is through the website, which is still www.lavictoria, and that's Spanish, so it's LAVICTORIA, and then just productions after that, .com. That has everything, and that's the mega site at the moment. And like I said, it's unfortunately kind of on its last legs because there's just so much stuff on there. I've almost got to take it down and redo it as something else. So for those next couple months, because I always say this, and it takes me 6 months to get around to doing it, because I always like to get somebody good to look at it. You know, while that's there, please go enjoy all the Dirty 20 episodes, all the What Are You Guys Talking About episodes, all of our short films, some of the music videos that we've done, some of the other works that we have done, just about anything you can think of. I'm always most proud of the sizzle reel, just because it kind of showcases everything that's good, and I always think it's the really good, you know, really well-edited version of Shredders as well. So you can check out all that stuff with us. But let's go on to what we start with, which is first impressions. Oh, and sorry, I forgot all the tags, didn't I? So social media, Jason Chereau, Ed Burgos, or Love Victoria Productions for Facebook. On Instagram, we are AnanoLVP and Jazzy J. Sherrell. On Twitter, we are at MouthLoveVictoria or at AnanoskiProd. On LinkedIn, we have a Love Victorious page. And on TikTok, we are at LVPFilmLife. Okay, first impressions. There you go, Ed.
Well, I didn't think I would. I didn't think I was going to enjoy this that much, I'll be honest with you.
Okay. And why was that?
Because we've been watching a few Paul Thomas Anderson films of late. You know, we did The Master, and I think we talked about something else as well. And, like, I didn't enjoy them as much watching them this time as I did before.
Yeah, did you have a rewatch of Boogie Nights?
No, and I think I wouldn't enjoy it as much as I did when I first saw it.
I think I need to have a rewatch of Boogie Nights now that I've gotten on the PTA bandwagon. I don't know whether rewatching that film would make me like it more.
Well, so here's the thing. PTA, Paul Thomas Anderson, I just call him PTA.
We are in that camp. There's an entire camp of directors and filmmakers. That's just how they refer to him. So, sorry, guys.
So, PTA tends to do very dour films. And sometimes I really like that kind of stuff. But as I'm getting a little bit older, I'm skewing a little bit more towards I want to be entertained.
Ah, that's it, because we talked about There Will Be Blood. Yeah. That was the other one that I was like, just too much of a depressing
film. Great film. I've watched that a bunch of times. I think if I watched it again now, I think I would be a little bit bored. I don't know if that's a crime to say that. But anyway, bring it back to Licorice Pizza. That was kind of what I was expecting.
Yes.
You know?
Yes, absolutely.
And it very much is not that. I was smiling throughout the film. I came out of it in a better mood than I had gone in. It's very uplifting.
And I know what you mean, because I was lucky that I read Variety most mornings, usually, at least the headlines. I'll run through what's top on Variety for the day. And they had a headline when this first came out, which is about 2 weeks ago now, that was like, Paul Thomas Anderson does his first comedy. And I thought, yeah, that's my issue, is the comedy, is that, and I just had this with something else too, where it's like, everyone is always obsessed with tragedy. Like, do you not understand that back in the day, and I'm not talking like back in the day, like Shakespeare, even longer back than that, you were to pick whether you wanted to see a comedy or a tragedy, because it was on the title of the effing play. And I just don't like now that people like to switch that on and think it's clever. Like, oh, I made a comedy, but no, it has a shit ending, so it's really sad. And it's like, and I was like, no, that doesn't make it. Well, I'm going to talk about what, because I know exactly what I'm referring to here. But, and no one else does until I get to what I've watched this week. But that's what I mean. Like, this one, it was told to me as a comedy, so I walked in thinking, okay, if I look at this as having a good message and not being his normal, like, the world is a very dark, horrible place.
No one loves each other.
Exactly. Then I'm like, then maybe I'll like, and that's why I recommend this to everyone. Does it deliver? Like, for me, I am not a child of, but a fan of, you know, nostalgia hits of that era in Hollywood.
That's why I said that this was a very you film.
California. I moved to California on the basis that I thought everyone looked like that. And it did generally stay that way for a little while in LA when I was there, but it's changed quite a bit now. But this is a view back at, you know, in the 70s, which does play kind of a part in the movie as well, which I thought was interesting how he integrated that in. But listen, if you like that, if you like uplifting movies, if you like star-studded cast like we had for Don't Look Up, this again has a star-studded cast.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that more like in the main thing, but I friggin' loved the two leads who I've never seen in anything else.
It's a very good point. So it's a star-studded cast, except for the two that you're going to be watching the vast majority of the time. So thanks, Ed, because Ed always calls me out on my bullshit like that, and it's not deliberate bullshit.
It is star-studded to the point of, like, you actually spot people, and you're like, wait.
And I love, like, how he used them this way. And we'll talk about that, because it's not just star-studded. So Don't Look Up just has characters played by really famous people, and that is probably more the traditional star-studded cast. This, like, they appear, and they appear as characters in the story, and every single one of them is so unique.
To me, it's the epitome of a great cameo.
He saw that scene in the, he heard us, that's what happened, you know, because time shifting happened. No, he didn't hear us, but we made the comment when we watched The Master about the girl in the green dress. Oh man, how do you know me that well? It's because
you don't shut up.
Because it had girl in the title. Yeah, no, that's probably the easiest way. It was a girl doing a really, really not sexual, but really kind
of
like...
No, beautiful. Just beautiful. A walk through,
that's the thing.
Right?
People always think I'm a big perv. Like, I'm not a perv, guys. Nah. I just...
Oh, I'm just joking. I'm just joking.
Okay, so maybe I'm a little bit of a perv. But I'm more like obsessed with the beauty of... I mean, that's where my writing comes from, is I'm obsessed with the beauty of women. I just think women are beautiful, beautiful things. Like, just... Not things, you know? It's hard to describe, but... It's my worship of everything that is women's grace and beauty.
That's right.
And yeah, so that the girl with the green dress and the master, like, that, as I said, I could have made a whole movie out of that scene. And then the rest of the movie, I was like, oh, all right. Bring back the girl in the green dress. She was pretty good. This has a million of those moments. And they're integrated into the story. So I thought it was much better. Like,
yeah.
There's no, like...
I'm not going to lie. One of them bothered me a little bit.
Okay, we'll talk about it. So that's why I would say, again, this is Oscar bait, so this is longer. Yes. It was a long film. 2 hours and 30 minutes, is it?
You know what? It didn't even feel long.
No, it doesn't feel it at all, but it is. Yeah. Just in case, because some people might feel that drag at the end. The third act is definitely, I always say this.
1:30, yeah, it must be like 2 hours and a half.
The third act is a little bit slower in my view than the rest. It comes back around in the end, but there's this lag, which was the only time I was like, ooh, this is
I'm reliving this one just cut scene, which is so good.
Brilliant, right? So, that's what I mean. Like, if you're on this show, listening to this show because you're one of our filmmaker guys that listens every week because you're an indie filmmaker, you want good indie filmmaker films, watch this film.
Yeah, this is...
This is the end game for us. This is what we're aspiring as.
This is a master of his craft.
When we ride off into a sunset, we want them to see this film and be like, that's what he did. It was amazing.
This is a master of his craft. I think maybe for the first time in a while, making a film for an audience.
And having fun.
Yeah.
That's the other problem with PTA films. It doesn't look like anybody has fun his films. And this one, you could tell people were having fun.
Did you notice in the credits how many Andersons were in this film?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
100% him hanging with his family and his friends.
Yes.
And you can kind of feel it.
But it just so happens for PTA, and I do, at least I can't speak for Ed. I do get a bit smarmy about this because it's like fucking lucky for you. But... For him, that is his family, though. Like, this is what people don't always understand. Is he grew up in Hollywood, around these people. Like,
and that's another great
thing. He's one of the chosen few.
And that's one of the great things about
and
this film.
And you can tell in that film that he's not... Like, for once, because I'm a person that really hates that. And that's why, you know, I didn't like Jake Gyllenhaal for the longest time. Because it was like the only reason he gets you know, acting roles because his parents are screenwriters. Mm. Like, it's just sour grapes, to be honest. Because it really is cool to see... You know, people that can rise to that challenge.
I mean,
it's
his community, it's his people.
That's right, and that's what happens here, and that's why I got to say, you know, Jake Gyllenhaal always rises to the occasion anyway. So, do you know what I mean? Like, don't hate on people like that. This is a film showing you why PTA deserves what he got with this. Like, he's just showing you everything about where he grew up and how it was and the background. Anyways, watch this film. That's what we would say. If you
do you know what it kind of reminds me of in a little weird way? You've seen American Graffiti, right?
Sure.
Like George Lucas making a film about
his
a child, like an era that he grew up
around.
It's
not his, right? Because that's what we're talking about. This isn't about his childhood. No. I don't think. Like,
but it's like we kind of look at the 80s. You know, we're too young to remember the 80s, really, but we have a nostalgia for it. There's a lot that we love about it, you know?
Right.
And I think there's a lot of that in
And
in
you had that. That's why the music works in this, why everything else works.
We're going to talk about 30 minutes about the music, I think.
So what... the only thing I would say is anybody should avoid. Mm. Like, just because we do like to give good advice that way, and I do hear that people will actually not listen if we give some good advice that way. Who...
Shouldn't watch this.
Yeah, just so we can give that warning out to anybody listening. I honestly, like, I know last week I said everybody should watch that film, because I thought everybody should watch Don't Look Up. Mm. It's Oscar bait, so I'm like, everybody should watch it.
I guess maybe I would say I watched it in a cinema, you watched it in a cinema. I think we're both going to talk about how we got something quite special out of watching it in the cinema.
Mm.
But do you need to watch this in a cinema?
Well, that's the two-parter, because I just had this discussion with my wife about Scream. Mm. I'm going to go see it this week, but I was going to try to hold out to see if we could get a babysitter. Mm. Not this weekend, but the weekend after. Mm. Do you know what I mean? Like, it can make a difference. Mm. In this film, does it make a difference? This was the first PTA I ever saw on the big screen. And I think I went on to that about you, and I said, it made a difference to me. And we can talk about that much more in depth in the longer bit. But so the first part is, can you wait to see it at home? Does it need to be seen in a theater? Do you need to avoid this altogether? listen, if you're looking for the blockbuster, then avoid this.
Yeah.
This is not the Spider-Man. This is the Oscar bait because it's Oscar season, guys.
Mm-hmm. Yay!
And then do you need to... I'm kind of like this with any Oscar bait, though. Like, I'm like, you don't have to see Oscar bait in the cinema.
And a lot of people who vote for the Oscars don't.
Sent screeners. I say that, but with this one, if you are a PTA... See, this is because there's rudders and riders and everything else, isn't there, whenever I'm talking, like... So I've told you who shouldn't see this, but now I'm coming back again to say, but if you are a PTA fan and you like his stuff or you want to learn what he is amazing at, watch this in the cinemas. Because I told Ed, and we'll talk about it in the full discussion, about some of the scenes and some of the shots.
It's just much easier to kind of notice.
To absorb what he's trying to... Because that's it. Because we talked about this on The Master. Paul Thomas Anderson is a great director because he speaks through images, not through words. The best and the brightest... always do that. They don't, you know, Aaron Sorkin's the only guy we know that can just write dialogue to run you through everything that you need to know. Most directors that are phenomenal, like Scorsese and Paul Thomas Anderson, these are guys that use imagery to get you through scenes much better. And this is the masterclass in this. This is everything's about him not telling you things, but showing you what you need to see. So we'll leave it there, if that's okay, Ed, unless you have anything more on first impressions. And we will move on to, you wanted to talk about what you have been watching this week. So tell me, my good man.
So, you know, I've been on a Spider-Man kick since we saw new Spider-Man.
I thought you'd watch them all. What more Spider-Man has there been, my good man?
And I had to do it as my background as well. But I rewatched Into the Spider-Verse.
It sometimes gets forgotten, but yeah, one of the greatest films of about 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah. And boy, it's just so good. It's so good on every level, whether it's the writing, the animation. And I'm on a big animation kick right now.
I still love 35-year-old, or was it 40-year-old Spider-Man? Like, that's my favorite.
Yeah.
It's so me. It's like, listen, kid, when you get at my age, this is all going to be a bit different.
You know, Peter Porker and, you know, Peter Porker?
Yeah,
Spider-Man Noir. Just it was amazing to rewatch it. And I actually, one really cool thing, so I wasn't available on any platforms that I subscribed to, so I bought it on Amazon Prime, and it came with bonus features.
Oh, good.
Which I was like, oh, yes, this is how I want, this is what would make me buy more movies rather than just wait till they appear on Netflix or Prime or whatever.
Very cool.
But yeah, that was kind of the last Spider-Man film that I haven't watched yet is Spider-Man 2, the one with Doc Ock. Haven't seen that in a really long time.
Oh my god, I want to watch it again. Spider-Man 2, Kirsten Dunst, that is like, that's the quintessential Kirsten Dunst
one. It's the best one.
It's the best one!
Yeah, so I need to get on that.
Where have you been? now, Into the Spider-Verse, I mean, the only thing I could comment about that, because I comment on everything, don't I? But that is one of Amy Pascal's triumphs. Mm. So that was when people started noticing her as, because Kevin Feige gets all the attention. Yeah. And I even say that over Victoria Alonso and Luis de Esposito, they do just as much as work as he does, but people don't know him, you know,
He's the front man.
He's the face, right? Yeah. Out of those three producers. Amy Pascal, again, is the one that's been doing all of this over at Sony for ages now and trying to get it all to work. And Into the Spider-Verse was just her triumph. You know what I mean? It was a brilliant idea. It was her way of pushing back slightly against the Marvel Universe, saying, well, we can come up with cool shit too. And then that's, you know, I want to say, quintessential, I love to use that word. It led to that deal. It led to Spider-Man 3. Because something like Into the Spider-Verse piqued, I think, Kevin and Victoria and Louise's interest, saying, we could work with that.
We could definitely
work with that. So good shout out on that one. And if you haven't seen, Jesus, because there are a lot of people that like haven't seen it.
Oh god, you have to watch it.
Because the other thing I liked about, the thing I was trying to explain to Catherine, because we're watching, and I'll talk about that later, but Catherine hasn't done the Spider-Man thing, and what I liked, Into the Spider-Verse modernizes it, because it takes it into the more modern music, the more urban feel of Spider-Man that now has, you know?
Like, reality.
You're just updating New York to be not the New York of the 1980s that everybody loves, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles New York, the New York of now, you know what I mean? That is a very diverse and cool place.
Mm. And then I caught two shows on Disney Plus.
Okay.
One is What We Do in the Shadows.
You were telling me about that.
Which is
based on the movie.
Phenomenal. Yeah, it's basically a riff of the movie, because I kind of started rewatching the movie as well, and that's obviously all set in New Zealand, and and stuff like that. But this one's set...
We're coming to see you, Ian, we promise.
This one is set in Staten Island. And it's just... It's really funny. It's really, really, really funny. And it gets cool as well. Like, you know... I was expecting it to just be like a laugh, something that I could just put on and maybe have on in the background.
I'm such a hater of Staten Island. This could be really funny. One of my favorite stories is like, my family's from Brooklyn, okay, and part of Queens, so that tends to be places I stick out for. And I did, you know, I think some of my great-grandparents were buried in Staten Island, but for the most part, we shit on people in Staten Island. And so we were driving through, because to get to... Kennedy Airport, which is where we always leave when I go to see New York. You have to drive through Staten, through Queens and all that. And Becky is in the car. And she's like, you always talk about, you and your family always talk about that Staten Island's such a dump. Why do you say that? And we were literally passing the Staten Island dump on the left side. So like, because it is. Look at the trash pile over there. Staten Island's a dump. It's not. Staten Island's a really cool place, but it's not Queens or Brooklyn. So,
But yeah, it's got a really good cast. And it's Taika, right? It's got Taika all
over. So he's backing the series as well, then. Yeah,
he's right. He's written a lot of them, and he's directed a few.
He's done a Jordan Peele now. He's moved so far up the echelon. You see him as executive producing so many different things. I'd like to see the next thing he's going to do, though. You know what I mean? Do you know what he's working on at the moment?
Well, I mean, Thor, Love and Thunder.
Is Love and Thunder his beast?
Yeah, that's going to come out soon.
That's what he's working on, then. Yeah.
Yeah, but really good, really fun. I recommend.
I love that, you know, the movie, and it's one of those things. I loved it because my wife loved it as much as I did. Rarely do we have something that we both artistically like. I just have that whatever. And we watched it; she couldn't stop laughing. You know?
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah, and the last thing that I watched, which I was actually watching before you came, Dave, which is what's his full name? Anyway, he's Little Dicky. The comedy rapper. I don't know if you ever know.
Okay. No.
I first saw him where he was going from like really expensive house to expensive house to yachts and being like, hey, we're making a music video and we were just wondering if we could, we're trying to do it for as low budget as we can, like for free. Can we use just the outside of your building or your house or your yacht?
How did that go?
Yeah, a lot of people were like, yeah, sure, go for it. Like, you know, it was very, very funny, but very much a kind of comedy rapper, and there's been plenty of them. But this show, man, I think you should definitely watch it.
Okay, definitely.
It's,
you say Dave, I thought you were talking about the old film, and I'm like, yeah, that was a great film about the president, or at least the guy pretending to be the president.
No.
You're like, no one's ever seen that film, Jason. Not since
you... I remember that.
Not since you were little.
Yeah. It's really funny, and then it also has some poignancy to it.
Okay.
And I think that's where you would really appreciate it.
Okay.
Like, it delves into... pretty hefty topics like mental health and relationships and
interesting
the drive to succeed versus, you know, how much effort you put into a relationship and stuff like that. Like, all really, really interesting stuff.
Shit that I talk Ed's ear off about.
Well, this is why I think you'd like it.
Definitely.
It's got things that you'll connect with. But yeah, what about you? What have you been watching?
Couple things that I wanted to mention. First, I finished Atlanta again.
Uh-huh.
It never takes long. It literally just was because I hadn't been home enough to watch the last three episodes. But I just love that show. And I can't wait to the third season. Supposedly, some of it takes place in London. I mean, it makes sense. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to be on the European tour. So hopefully we get to see a little Lundy action there.
Cool.
But again, a lot of that's just... it's the same reason I listen to Childish Gambino, at least Camp, because I just see some...
You're inspired by it.
I'm inspired, but there's a kinship there. There's a whole, like, I get where you're coming from. And I get, like one of my favorite scenes, because it reminds me of me. And that's just showing you how vain I am. But that kind of stuff helps me with my writing. It helps me take a direction with things. And there's this scene in the penultimate episode. Probably my favorite scene in Atlanta in general, because it epitomizes Earn's character. So Earn obviously is the manager, but he's not really. Like, he's trying to figure... again, the other thing we love it is he's a guy trying to figure everything out, and he gets it wrong all the time, and he's just so frustrated by it, because it's not for lack of wanting to get things right. It's more, you know, he just doesn't know. He's not connected. He doesn't have the same opportunities that a bunch of other people have. And then you get to this scene where they go to this college, and then all sorts of shit breaks out at the college. And that's just a great episode in general to show you how she can go from, you know, zero to crazy in 10 seconds with her manager. However, my favorite scene is they're driving back, and the whole reason this all got messed up, at least on one level, and there's a lot of different levels to the conversation going on in this episode, because Earn's worried about getting fired, and his cousin, which is the rapper he works for, is thinking about it too, and there's all this, like, what should he really be doing? Should he be allowing this to happen? Shouldn't he be allowing this to happen? What is he supposed to be doing as manager? Well, in the particular episode, something happens that he doesn't stop. It causes them to leave. But they're in a car, and the guy who caused the incident is this big, tall ex-prison convict. And then he starts talking shit to Earn, and Earn's just had enough. And Earn's like, fuck you. You know, fuck this. And he says a bunch of other things which I can't say on the podcast because people will think it's a white guy saying it. Pulls over the car, you know what I mean? And he gets out, and then he promptly gets the shit kicked out of him by this tall ex-con, and then just sits in the back of the car. And then the next episode, they're like, you all right? He's like, yeah, I'm straight. And I just, I'm sorry, I don't know why that resonates so well with me, but I was like, yeah, I get it. Like, I get it. You just had to call out. So what if you know you're getting your ass beat? But, you know, like, you gotta do what you gotta do, you know? So, finish that up. And then I was just looking for, like, Oscar bait to watch this week. So I watched, you know, we were talking about tragedies and comedies, so I watched Being the Ricardos.
Oh, okay. I want to watch that. Good?
Good. Worth a watch. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can't, like, it's one of those, it'll be a bit like The Matrix, where, like, I liked it, but I'd rather talk about the things that were weird about
it. Oh, I need to mention something about The Matrix when you finish. Yes. Keep going.
One, obviously, Nicole Kidman playing Lucille Ball.
Mm-hmm.
Does it work? I don't know. Like, I don't... I feel like she's going to come in here and slap me if I'm disrespectful to Nicole Kidman. Because I do have that much respect for you. Like, I just think you are one of those timeless actors.
Meryl Streep, fuck her.
Yeah, so... No, so... Like, so fuck her to Meryl Streep. Like, I really don't have the love. I haven't... I'm going to watch the movies, Meryl, and then we're going to be friends. Because I haven't seen all these films that everybody loves that you're in. I haven't seen you in a lot of stuff. Death Becomes Her is the only one I can think of that I absolutely love Meryl Streep in that. Mm. But Nicole Kidman, yeah, I can think of a lot of films. And she dated one of my favorite dudes on the planet, Lenny Kravitz, who had nothing but nice things to say about her. So, do you know what I mean? Like, she's up there. However, I'm not sure I bought it. Like, it almost made me think of, you remember that Tropic Thunder where they're like, he had special surgery to blah, blah, blah. Like, I felt like, did she have surgery to try to make her look more like Lucille Ball? And those prosthetics? Like, but it goes about halfway. She looks like and this is where I mean I'm not trying to be disrespectful. She looks like a really old Lucille Ball to me.
Right.
And that's because, you know, when I saw Lucille Ball, it was in black and white through reruns. I mean, we're like double reruns. That had already been rerun in my parents' era. Mm. It's being rerun again. And it is one of those shows that every American loved. You know what I mean? It's a great show. The movie itself, well story made, and instead of trying to tell you the entire story, they do bits and pieces.
Mm.
And one of the cooler things, they do it by asking like actual people that worked on that set will start the story out and be like, well, this happened. And they pick like one particular week where things went shit and then bounce around a little bit to show you some of how you got there and how, you know, the show got being.
How's Javier?
He's amazing.
Okay.
Like, and I'm not saying that Nicole's not amazing. She's, she's always amazing. Yeah. You know what I mean, always amazing. It's just, there's I can sometimes hear the Australian accent, and it's like, or not even Australian, it's her accent, because she doesn't even really have an Australian. Right. It's like Margot Robbie's Australian accent that doesn't really exist anymore.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? So, there's just that element that takes me out of it sometimes, and it's Nicole Kidman, not Lucille Ball. But for the most part, with Ricky Ricardo at Javier Bardem, Javier Bardem is not as recognizable to me as someone like Nicole Kidman, so that probably helps with it, but no, I mean, he's playing a Cuban, he knows...
So he kind of blends into the character, whereas Nicole Kidman kind of bleeds through a little bit?
And some of that's just racial prejudice, though. It's because he's playing a Cuban that has an accent, so it's like, it's not as hard for him to pull off Ricky Ricardo, because I never really remembered what Ricky Ricardo looked like, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
he was just a Cuban guy, you know what I mean? And there's Babalu, everybody goes, Babalu, you know? Those aspects I loved, and I also love the aspect of, like, showing you what was really going on there. It really tries to emphasize... A, that Ricky Ricardo loved America and was like the showrunner. Like he controlled everything because he believed it was that important and his wife loved him for that. I also loved that interplay. Lucy and Desi, I'm sorry because this isn't Ricky Ricardo, it's Desi Arnaz.
Yeah.
You know, Lucy and Desi, like, Yeah, like I'm not saying my marriage is as cool as that. But
very Oscar baity, right? This film.
I would say so, yeah. But this is the tragedy comedy, so I'm about to ruin this for you. But it's not really ruining for you because it's historical. So this is something you could look up anyway. So you get through this whole thing, and there's the ups and there's the downs, and they love each other, but they can kill each other, and I love that because my you know relationship with my wife can be like that sometimes. Like I definitely have that kind of fire and passion. You know what I mean? And then it ends, and it's like, and this is going to ruin the ending, so skip ahead just 3 minutes. Otherwise, I don't think it's really going to ruin everything for you. It's just, I think you should know this before going in.
Okay.
So one of the things that goes back and forth is whether Desi has cheated on her or not. And they go back and forth, and he says no, and he says no, and he says no, and he says no, and he says no. The last scene in the fucking movie, what about this? What about this is her lipstick? This is blah, blah, blah. It was only the one time, baby. And then it cuts to Lucy and Desi broke up the day after the show ended.
Happy go lucky.
I just...
Enjoy your day.
Exactly, right? I sat through this whole thing where they're trying to tell me that this was worth something because the two of them loved each other and they were making this. And this was... This is the reason that things got hard on the show, but they really made it work because they had to, because it was for them so they could be together. And then somebody... And it's such a... It's such a postmodern thing to do because the thought is you would rather have the truth on this. I'm being honest with you. Fuck off. Like, no.
Like, it's not even about it, you know, lying about it. It's more about like the way it's presented.
You know exactly how I mean, right? It fades to black and then you get this little bit that says like, oh, by the way, and it's like, what are you trying to say? It's
such a just dead thud at the end, you know.
It is. Does that mean that, you know, the problem is the type of culture we live in now is, you know, cancel culture. It's like, well, that's going to make everyone rush to a decision. Like, you just saw the minutia, the gray area of what's going on there. That's the appreciative part. Don't get me wrong. Like, I can completely make the counter argument that you want the truth at the end, but I'm not like that.
It's a choice, right?
It's a choice. And it's the whole reason I didn't like Million Dollar Baby because I was like, like no, like that's not entertaining to me. That's not Oscar bait either to me because it's obvious. Like, isn't it a tragedy that someone has trash parents and then she breaks her neck and it's horrible?
Oscar bait can be a little bit like, oh, just like cry and watch this.
Do you know what I mean? And like, I thought we were getting away there because the argument was, and this especially happened with the female directors we hang out with, was all like, I'm really tired of hearing the story of the white male on a journey of self-reflection. Which, you know, the problem is until I sat with a bunch of female directors who all said the same thing to me, like within an hour period, and then I looked back at the movies I loved, I was like, wow, how many are those of a white guy on a trip of self-reflection?
Yeah.
So, okay, all right, like, I get it. Like, we're trying to be more honest with things, but this wasn't a story I wanted told that way. Like, I know things suck and that these things are hard. Like, I was more happy to see how hard they tried when they were together. Like, I guess...
Sometimes it works for me, sometimes it doesn't. And I feel like I said, as I'm getting older, I want to see the glass half full. I want to be...
Yeah, because you know, I was the same way with House of Gucci. Some people are going to love House of Gucci because it's just like murder that happens because of betrayal and blah, 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 blah. But I was just like, can you not show some of the good sides of the Guccis? They weren't horrible people. I mean, they were rich, so they weren't the nicest people in the world, but... Do you know what I mean? It's Gucci, for fuck's sake. You know what I mean? Like, they created a brand that's iconic.
Mm.
And that wasn't because they were idiots. That was because, you know, because they had that kind of know-how.
Mm. I think that's kind of an easy target.
It was.
In the world today, that's an easy target.
You know, and I do it too. You know, anytime you want to say, oh, rich people, they're so privileged. Like, fuck yeah, they're privileged. Of course they're privileged. That's the whole point. You know what I mean? But that doesn't take away sometimes from what they're doing or the art and things like that.
Are you going to get to King Richard?
Ooh, yeah, I can. I think so. Actually, this week, I may be watching... It was really funny because I almost got her to see it with me at the Curzon. But my wife... I was like, what do you want to watch lately? What's hot for you? Because it's Oscar season. And it's a lot of stuff at the box office. And I'm the movie guy. So, you know, you want to go see anything? She's like, oh, I really wanted to see Macbeth. And I was so pleased because it's Apple TV. So I was like, oh, nice. Oh, we watch that at home. I ain't got to take you out for that, baby. So she was pleased about
it. Is that the Coen brothers?
Yeah, with Denzel Washington as Macbeth. Wow. So I am very much looking forward to watching that with my wife. And I think that's the thing you wouldn't know about her. Like, and it's not, I don't know why you wouldn't know it about her, but it's just not something she wears. Like we wear our likes on our sleeves.
Yeah.
And she doesn't. She's just not that type of person. She
literally
loves,
I'm wearing a you know.
Didn't my wife buy that for you?
Yeah. No. This was in the loot box, in the Stranger Things loot box.
Right.
I'm wearing a Stranger Things t-shirt, just so you know.
We gotta get back to Comic-Con to get more loot boxes.
Stop it. Money. Okay.
So I watched that. Mm. I'm trying to think if there's anything else interesting this week that I watched. That I found on Prime Video and I was like really happy about that.
Mm.
I think that was it. Yes. Yeah, we'll move on from there because we need to talk about Licorice Pizza.
Yes.
So one of the first comments, we're just going to do this question style because okay. I find that to be the quickest way. I'll ask you some questions, you ask me some questions.
I love this.
And by then it'll get to like fucking an hour and a half easy.
Okay.
But we were texting about this, Ed, and you said, you know, I told you this might be my favorite film of the year, and you were like, yeah, this is definitely a you film. Mm-hmm. Why do you say that, Ed?
Because I think that this is very much a romantic film, but told in a very kind of, you know, no holds barred kind of way. Not in the intense way that something like Marriage Story or something like that is, right? This is more uplifting. This is about young love. And I think you're very much a kind of young at heart, romantic person.
Absolutely,
you know?
Absolutely.
And then on top of that, it's LA in the 70s, which you are all about.
It's Encino in the 70s, right. Too. That's like a suburb of LA in the 70s. That is oh man, that is just it. That is like, that's what they sold me on when they were like, come to California, it'd be great. I'm like,
so
yes,
I mean, when I heard what it was about, I was like, okay, I'm pretty sure Jason will enjoy it, even if it's a P.T.A. Anderson film.
But there is just so much imagery to all of that, too, that I love, though. So, like, yes, that's definitely the premise. Like, it's definitely this romanticism, this, you know, because that's the struggle in the film between the couple is this shouldn't work. Like,
no.
I'm, you know, he's 15, I'm 25, or however old she is.
That's right.
It changes a couple times, right? Mm. But, you know, this is, you know, it's illegal on paper. And the other thing is, like, there's just all these obstacles, right, that come up. And what I loved about the film, it was all about, like, but none of that matters because you like each other, because you care about
each other. There's real
love there. And because when there's real love in this world, and this isn't me trying to say that I have, like, some 15-year-old love on the side, but do you know what I mean? Like, because I was getting there, like, wow, that's a bold statement, PTA. But he does make that statement saying, this is okay. Like, there's nothing wrong.
We will overcome. That's kind of what it feels.
He does it through a lot of, like, I am really impressed with the way he does sexual imagery. Because it's very subtle.
And it
was, I mean, in The Master, it wasn't. And in The Master, I was like, I get that you're a bit of a perv on the inside, dude. I get it. You wrote Boogie Nights, so you can't not be, right? Yeah. However, you know, the way he...
It was very dark. It was sexually dark.
Dark and just a bit clunky. Mm. Like, Joaquin Phoenix humping something in the sand, like, I get it. Okay, wow, did I really understand that one? When they all just appear naked and everybody... Yeah. You know, so I thought that was going to be the moment that you're like, no, this is what he means. And I'm like, oh. But no one really gets why all of a sudden, you know.
At no point is it really.
And poor Amy, like, I really hope you knew why he made you drop trowel in that scene. Because, I mean, you're beautiful. You're absolutely beautiful. But dude's trying to get you naked. I'm just saying. But this one, like, he couldn't because they were all underage. But look at the dress and look at the style and look at how he pictured everything, and it wasn't just the girls, it was the boys, it was the adults. Like, he sexualizes certain things so quickly without doing it, and I just love that, because that's exactly why this is this thing that you want to have happen, but it makes you feel uncomfortable all the way through it.
Yeah.
And then
like you said, it's never explicit, it's never like in your face in any way, like it was in other
films. It's so subtle, because he's like, he presents a 15-year-old that is actually more adult than most adults that you see, at least in that part. And so it's like, what is the difference?
It also feels like a comment on the times as well.
Exactly. Like, if you're going to make the kid live this way, why can't he be, you know...
It was a more innocent time, but then at the same time, it was a freer time, and... It does make it sound kind of creepy now. I'm like kind of saying it out loud.
Because we live in a different era.
Yeah, exactly.
But you have to think like The Graduate, because that's what we're talking about here. You know what I mean? Yeah. And it's a little bit different from The Graduate, because it's 3 years younger than The Graduate, and he hadn't graduated shit yet. So, you know what I mean? But the kid as he is like not really a kid. He's one of these child actors that has grown up because he's been, you know. And I think the way that I was sold on it was the way that he doesn't seem remorseful about that. It's not... Most of the time when we get a child actor presented to us, and a lot of times that they're speaking to the media these days, it is the postmodern. It's the, it sucked. My life was taken away from me. You know, right. I never got to. This kid doesn't say any of that. He's like, no, yeah, I run businesses. Yeah, I get to do my own shit. Yeah. I do what I want. Yeah. And the best was that his mom is the lady from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
She's the waitress.
That's right. That's right. The alcoholic waitress. I love it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's almost like you hear the ages at first and immediately you're like, oh, shit, this is going to end up pretty badly. And yet it does feel like just another hurdle in their kind of love story.
That's the romanticism. His confidence. So the lead actor, who was the lead on this? What was it?
I don't even know.
He looked. This is a looky-loo. He looked like Gandolfini's son. Because I just saw the Many Saints of New York. It wasn't him. And I said, this is a new look they're going for in Hollywood.
Cooper Hoffman.
Oh, Cooper.
He was born in 2003.
Oh, don't say that.
And this is his film debut.
Yeah. I mean, can you believe that? Can you believe that is a debut performance?
Mm. Oh, shit. Do you know whose son it is?
Whose son is it? Here we go. Here's
Cooper Hoffman.
Is it Dustin Hoffman's son?
No, Philip Seymour Hoffman's son.
Oh, my God.
Holy shit. My mind just got blown.
That's like Ed's favorite.
But
it explains that, doesn't it?
When Pierce Hoffman died, I was really upset, man. I felt like it was the best actor of my lifetime going. That's amazing. Okay, mind just blown. I had no idea.
Not a bad debut for a family legacy there.
No, and obviously he worked a lot with, you know, PTA and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So, again, it kind of highlights more this, like, you know, family thing. That they seem to be doing. You know?
Right. So, I mean, and that was, aside from the romanticism, the other thing, and this is why I want to get it back over to you a little bit, talk more about what I called Ed about and told him on text to say why you need to see it in the theater. So I was mentioning that before in the podcast. Listen, I've never seen a film that does so much with close-ups.
Mm.
Like, he really just, the last time I saw something like this, I was talking about Mother, which was a guy who did Requiem for a Dream.
Yes. That?
Darren Aronofsky.
Yeah.
And Darren, and at the time when I was talking about Mother, I thought it was because obviously him and J-Law were dating at that time.
Yeah.
And he was obsessed with her. Like they end up breaking up later because the movie doesn't go right. I mean, there were all sorts of interesting stories about that relationship, which I'm sorry got, you know, all over the tabloids. So who knows if it's true or not. But it seemed true to me because when you watched Mother, the camera was on her shoulder the vast majority of the time. And everything's about coming up to people's faces. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't seen many on the big screen like that. Because most, I would say, modern films aren't done that way. This one is back to showing you all the joy and the weirdness. Like, you either get a close-up to show you someone smiling or someone enjoying themselves. Or you get it to show, like, some weird, like, one of my favorite characters was the the talent agent. The woman, she's been in Desperate Housewives, and she always plays these really kind of salty, just awful characters. And she was the one who said, would you do this? Would you do that?
Mm-hmm.
And they got, obviously, right up in her face, and she has the facial features just to make
Harriet Sansom.
Yeah, Harris. I mean, she even, the minute you were up there, it just looked even grimier than it did when she was asking the questions. You know what I mean? It just works so perfectly. But again, some of that setting as well, because these shots are always done like with a backlighting of the California sunset coming in through the background. I mean, I just felt you had to experience that as big as it was on the screen, because then you see the little twitches in the corner of the mouth, and there's a lot of that in this film about people not wanting to be joyous about something and being kind of forced into it.
This will also teach you a lot about focal length.
Okay.
In terms of the close-ups that he uses, which give no head space, they cut off the top of the head and sometimes the bottom as well, the chin. And he's very clearly using quite a long lens.
Okay.
You know, anything from like 80 millimeters or higher.
All right, so it's almost like a telephoto.
Almost, yeah. Because what it does is, rather than a wide-angle lens, which often like flattens your face and makes you look a little weird.
No, I mean, he's filming people as if they were animals. That's what's the interesting thing. Telephoto, I use telephoto obviously when I'm out in the forest and stuff like that, because you need your close-ups with the animals. You're never going to get remotely close to them. And no, I'm not one of those guys that will sit for like 7 hours and wait for something, but I do have a telephoto lens where I can get it out there so I can get right in the bird's face or whatever it is. But isn't that interesting to be using, you know...
It just works. I mean, and he really is the master of camera placement and camera movement. Every time the camera moves, it's saying so much and doing so much for...
So give us some examples, buddy, because I know there'll be some good scenes in that you love.
There's a lot of running in this film.
There is. It's a theme, right? Yeah. It's a theme, and it. I like how he even encapsulates it at the end. He reminds... He's not afraid to say, like, this is why I threw all the running in there, because it's the comedy.
So beautiful. But like you say, you know, the silhouetting of a character. He's not afraid of darkness, which I find a lot of my favourite... filmmakers do that, you know, and one of the reasons why he works a lot with Roger Deakins, because Deakins is just like he paints with light, but he also paints with darkness. There's a couple of scenes where he's tracking a shot, so he's going in front of Alana, who's the main character, and he used that technique in The Master with the girl in the green dress, and he gives her a certain like kineticism and fury, which the character very much has. You know, there's this like pent up anger.
How much did you like her as the female lead?
She was amazing.
Not something that we've seen in a while. They make jokes about it in the film. So the closest thing I could kind of put to her was a Barbara Streisand. Back in the 70s, Barbara Streisand it wasn't always the angel that you know, and sometimes she was in movies. I have a couple on my list, and I love Barbara Streisand, just so you guys know. But like a couple on my list where she's more the spunky kind of Jewish girl that is, you know, supposed to be intelligent and, you know, like even Fiddler on the Roof, that's kind of the character she's playing in that. So at any rate, I love the fact that they were harnessing it and then not harnessing it. And then obviously you had the Bradley Cooper scenes and all that, which is like, Streisand, you know? But she was epitomizing that, the 70s view of a Jewish girl, of like, you know, where they were in society and what they were supposed to be and how it didn't quite fit.
I found it really interesting.
You've got a very Jewish nose.
Yeah. I found it really interesting because when I saw her sisters, I was like, wow, they really do look really similar. And it turns out that they're all in a pop band together.
There are an awful lot of Hames in that family. Is that Corey's? Are they related to Corey Haim?
I don't know.
It's the only other time I ever had seen that last name.
But they're in a pop band together.
Are they?
Yeah.
I went Daniel Haim in one of our movies. So.
Called Haim. She's the main singer.
She's going to be in one of our movies. Because like, all she does is sit and smoke weed through half the film. And she just does it looking so goddamn cool. And I was like, yeah, I don't even know if I need to cast her in an actual role. I'll just have her as that girl.
Can I also say that I really liked that they weren't, like, traditionally attractive, either of them, you know? It felt like they had a little bit of, like... reality to them.
That's what I would say. Like, how much did you like the scene in this? Did you get the vibe? Did you like the vibe in the film? Or was it like, it's a weird place? Like, how did you feel about seeing? Because you've never been to California.
Well, yeah, I mean, I do it very much as a kind of outside observer where I've seen it through films and stuff like that. And it's funny because I did think about this while I was watching it. But obviously New York has a very... very delineated place in the world of cinema as like a character in a lot of movies.
It is. Right? It has its... I like how you say that because in Only Murders in the Building is a great example of that. Of like, if you put New York, at least you put Central Park, New York, Manhattan in a film, it's going to look a certain way. It's going to feel a certain way.
Yeah.
And the thing I would tell you about that's okay with me because there's an accuracy to that. Mm. Like, if you went to New York today, there's an accuracy to the people on the street that you're going to see.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Some of the Lower East Side and all that's changing, but you know what I mean? Like, that is the New York that's been there for 20, 30 years.
But it's very familiar. Yes. You know? Whereas Hollywood, LA, I would struggle a little bit beyond... you know, Sunset Boulevard or just some very, very iconic places.
Strangely, like, I have this, like, set of favorite films. I wouldn't say Alpha Dog is one of my favorite films, but I love, obviously, that it's very authentically California.
Alpha Dog, I haven't seen
that. That's that one, Justin Timberlake. I wouldn't, because it was when I said it has, like, the worst murder scene in it ever. Okay. Which ruins that movie for you. But yes, they are going to kill Anton in that film. Anton, poor guy got hit by the guy that's dead now.
Yeah, yeah.
But that was one of his better performances, but he's the victim in that. Mm. You know what I mean? And it's just a horrible scene. I hate those. I don't like it when, like, they're like, it's okay, we're just going to kill you now. And he's crying and he's carrying on. Never mind. But then you've got Lords of Dogtown.
Yes, that's the skating...
I don't know if we've ever watched that together. That is one of my all-time favorites. Because I love skating and I love California.
I haven't seen it.
And that is telling you about California. Like, that's obviously California, because that's showing you the skate culture and where these guys...
Is it a documentary?
No. The Lords of Dogtown, the Dogtown and the Z-Boys is the documentary. Gotcha. Lords of Dogtown was the movie. Mm-hmm. Has Heath Ledger in it, actually.
Okay. Is it set in the 80s or 90s or
something? It's the 70s. It'll be the same era as this. Oh, because Stacey Peralta and all of them come out in the late 70s. So this is more early 70s. That's why we have early Bowie.
Yeah.
You know, going with everything. God, I've been listening to Hunky Dory all this week.
Every time I hear that guy, I'm like, I need to listen to more Bowie.
You do. Everybody does. Yeah. Like, he's so phenomenal. Like, I went back to, I haven't listened to Hunky Dory in like 20 years. And I was like, oh my God, I forgot. This was like his first really awesome album. He's got so many good ones. All I was asking about the vibe and why I'm going on about it is like that they capture so well. Yeah. When I moved to California, it was because I liked hanging out with people like that. And they get around with that whole hangout culture. It's very different from the East Coast.
Yeah.
And something that actually after a while took me back because people do just hang out. Like you're just chilling. You're doing stuff. Like, you know what I mean? There's just not the pacing that you have on the other side of the country. Mm. And it's so weird because it's still America.
Right,
all the same place. It's just California has a much different flow to it. And Southern California, where that is. Mm. And the problem is, because it's so close to Hollywood, I think anytime it's really put into pictures, film, you know, they want Hollywood. Once upon a time, Hollywood was all about the celebrities. What I loved about this was not about celebrities, even though I had tons of them in there. It was about the shit at the bottom, which is what most people... Yeah. That's the other thing. This is about most people in L.A., not the ones at the top. Because, you know, everybody goes to L.A. with that dream.
And yet, everyone's slightly connected to it as well. Which I think... It gives it a really authentic feel to a place that, like, you don't see on screen very often, you know? But yeah, I did dig the vibe. It was cool. Again, I knew that this was totally in your wheelhouse. Just like if you watch, like, a steampunk thing, you're like, oh, Ed's gonna like this shit.
I fell asleep to that again this week, so I tried to
Arcane.
Again. I got through, I think, half of it.
Half of it. It's going to be one of those things where I love it so much, and you're just like, nah, it's not for me.
I know, I mean, what I watched was good, all right. It wasn't keeping me awake, that's all.
Fair enough.
I'll go back to bed now. No, I mean, I was watching it late at night anyway. Some more stuff on PTA's Licorice Pizza.
40 mil to make. I was surprised when I just read that.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. That doesn't surprise me. An Oscar bait doesn't usually hit the 50 to... 100 million mark. I guess where I'd be surprised at the 40 mil, and the reason you won't be able to make this picture is he must have got an awful lot of fucking favors from Maya
that's
Rudolph,
what I'm thinking,
Bradley
yeah.
Cooper.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he's married to Maya Rudolph, obviously, so he just like...
Oh, okay. You told me that 20 times, and I knew there was some connection. I knew. This is the worst thing. This is why I'm still not a real producer yet, because I'd be sitting in a room with the two of them, and I'd be like, I know there's some connection between you. Like, yeah, we're married. Like, oh, yeah, that's it. Ed told me that.
But it does have, like, you know, Tom Waits in there.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah, sorry. Like, now you're getting me excited again. Because, unfortunately, I'm just not reliving the movie enough right now. Like, scenes like that, where it's like the girl's pissed off at the boy. So she goes to his favorite restaurant. Mm. But then she goes with Sean Penn playing, I guess, a famous director or a famous actor.
A famous actor.
And then Tom Waits shows up and it just goes, things just go crazy. There were a few moments like that. Mm. And what I liked is... It was the opposite of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood with stuff like that. Every time you met, like, the celebrities, shit just got weird, you know? Like, obviously culminating, the weirdest one was Bradley Cooper, who's playing... Like, who is he supposed to be?
He's supposed to be a film producer, John Peters.
Oh, my God! Like, it was hilarious!
He was
like,
so good.
Fucking kill you. Fucking kill you.
I'll chuck your brother out. He's so good. He's so, so good. But, okay... I had a little bit of a problem with Sean Penn in this.
Why?
I found it distracting.
Why?
Because I guess I don't... Like, Bradley Cooper is a funny dude, you know? He's been in comedies.
Streisand. Say it with me.
Streisand.
No, you're still saying it.
And I know, you know, he did Piccoli back in the day, and he has done comedies. The Woody Allen one where he plays the jazz guitarist is actually, like, a great film. I love that film.
We're talking about Sean Penn here.
Yeah.
I've never seen him in anything really funny, to be honest with
you. Well, this is my point. And I was, like, kind of half expecting it to get serious at this point. Like, at one point, I was like, oh, no, is she going to get murdered by someone? Is someone like a, you know, Charlie Manson? Is Charlie Manson going to pop up in this one as well? Do you know what I mean?
That's Ed's version. Ed loves this era in California in the 70s, but he sees Charlie Manson everywhere.
So it wasn't bad. It was just it threw me off a little bit.
Okay.
In that moment.
Interesting.
And
that can happen, I guess.
And I did really, because you're right, it's all about her and him, right? Alana and Gary, and like what they're kind
of
doing
to
each other.
The epitome, another running scene, the epitome of that scene is he takes off in the bike, she gets flung off the back, and then he just decides, fine, I'll go get her, and he runs all the way up the golf course. While Tom Waits is still like, I just love that character. I was like, are you out of your fucking
mind? I love that. Bradley Cooper was great. The agent. Like, all the little cameos really work for me, just for
some reason. I generally don't like Maya Rudolph. Not because you're not cool, just because generally you're funny doesn't get to me, for whatever reason that is. I just don't find you funny. Mm. But this one, like, I thought she was perfect for that, because that little snooty look she kept giving, like, it was great.
Yeah, she was fantastic.
Oh, but my favorite random cameo, and I didn't even know who the cameo was by, but it was the one who's the, she's the lead for the nine in a bed or whatever it is, and she's so awful to them.
So she's supposed to be a kind of Lucille Ball kind of character. And George DiCaprio,
is that like related to Leo, or
so he is the father of actor Leonardo DiCaprio. Yeah.
And who does he play?
He plays the guy who sells them the waterbeds.
Far out.
Yeah. Man. That guy, which really stuck out to me as well. I was like,
that's the parts I thought you'd really see me in there. The guy's like, these are going to sell like crazy. The next day he's like, we got to get some fucking waterbeds. That's the reason I love the main character, because that is how I think
it's
up. Someone comes up with an idea, I'm like, let's do it. Let's make money.
Full of names you'll recognize as well. Oh, dude, the guy who owns the Japanese restaurant.
Oh my God! Oh, see, my right? Like, gosh. This is why we're doing this, and this is the LVP. This is what are you guys talking about? This is what we mean. We just have to walk through the movie together, and then we'll start doing geeking out.
Oh my God!
Because it happens twice. The first time, I'm not kidding. In the middle of the theater, I was like, "What the fuck?"
Yeah. Yeah.
How will we rock it very much?
It's so
awful. Oh, I don't speak Japanese.
But then at the same time, yeah. But then at the same time, it kind of puts you in that place in time, right?
It does.
It's like I could almost imagine PTA having grown up with someone like this around.
Yeah, someone that just turns to their Japanese wife and is like, hello.
Yeah,
and how are we doing?
And clearly, like, because he marries another Japanese woman. Like, he's married again in a later scene.
That's what I mean with genius. Like, that is such a genius character, because it's so wrong, but it works so well in the scenes. Like, it's so funny.
Yeah, because the actor's also, he's brilliant in a lot of comedies and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, no, that was, yeah. That's what I mean. The movie is a set of, it's almost like a Tom Sawyer or a Huck Finn, where it has episodic nature like that.
Mm.
And some of it ties up at the end. So, that, you know, the waterbed far out guy is another one. What are some of the other really good ones with that? There were a ton.
And I liked the little kind of the politician.
That's the other one I was thinking of. Because who were the actors with that one? Like, those were, one was a child actor that I'd seen that is now grown up, or a teenage actor.
Yeah.
That is now grown up. That was his boyfriend.
Her boyfriend, like, for a little while, yeah.
His boyfriend. Did you get that? You got that, right?
No.
That was the whole problem at the end. Okay, so what did Ed think the problem with the politician was?
Oh, no, I got that.
So his boyfriend at the end, the politician's boyfriend.
Yeah.
That's an old child actor, a guy that was in Smallville and a couple other things.
Something, yeah. I definitely recognize
him. But I didn't, who was the politician?
I didn't recognize him. I didn't recognize the name. Yeah, yeah, he was very good. And again, so yes, it's a comedy, but this is PTA. So, and he is a guy who can give you some very poignant shit. In, you know, sometimes it's in a very dark way, you know, the relationship between the father and the son and There Will Be Blood. But like Punch Drunk Love, which is
a dark comedy, yeah.
Yeah.
So it has its funny moments.
But like, he wrote that thinking that he was making an Adam Sandler movie. Like, that's what he said. He said, I wanted to make an Adam Sandler movie when I wrote this.
It's as funny as he thought he could be. Which is not, it has its funny moments. There's
still a lot of not funny
moments in it.
But this one, I feel like really kind of struck a beautiful, perfect balance between just the young love aspect, and then also like the times.
I can see why you can fall in love with this director, because he is, you know, whether or not it's his entire team or just him, I can't tell you because I've not been on set. But
I mean, he writes a lot of his own stuff.
But his ability to take what he's feeling on the inside and put it on the outside in a really, it's funny because it's obvious from an artistic perspective, but it's never obvious from a messaging perspective. He doesn't tell you anything. He always just shows you things. And then you slowly start to get, oh, this is what he's talking about. And so this was huge on that. But I think, again, maybe it is his childhood. It must be, because this is, he grew up.
To a certain degree, I think so.
You know, yeah. And that's why there's such joy in all of this. This whole, like, I think sometimes, like you said, it comes across as, well, this is what I think of the world, and isn't that a shitty place? Mm-hmm. And isn't it a shitty place thing? Usually, even the master leaves that open-ended, but it's definitely leaning, you know, towards a postmodern, like, we're all going to die mentality, where this one was like, isn't the world a beautiful place? A crazy, weird, and completely fucked up. Because this is the early 70s in America, which was another, we've talked about this on the podcast. It's another era similar to what we're living in now, which was things sucked. You know, Nixon was in charge. Vietnam is still going. People are dying. There's a, as you saw, a gas crisis. You know, things aren't very good. And it was like, even in that, aren't we having fun with these two, you know, two characters?
And also a very kind of, I don't want to say realistic relationship, but a relationship with its issues and its dynamics. And like, very clearly from the start, you're like, okay, she's 25 and he's 15. Oh my God, this is definitely going to cause problems. And it's definitely a thread in the film where she thinks of him as being like a dumb kid sometimes. He doesn't care about the bigger world and stuff
that. The best scenes for that, and that's what I love, because there's no punches pulled. So in other words, they could have really softened that. If they wanted to make it more of a love story, you know, you want to increase the romanticism, then you make him into a better character.
Yeah.
And what I loved about it is they didn't. They're like, he's 15, so he's an idiot. Yeah. So he gets her in a bathing suit, and then he fucks around with another girl. Because like, that's what 15-year-old kids do.
They're
idiots.
I literally was in the cinema, and I was literally like, what did you expect? He's a horny man-child. You know?
You know, like even 25, they're still like that. You know what I mean?
But
like,
again, that dynamic.
At 40, we get a bit, you know, a little less crazy, but, you know.
And the way they did kind of try and make each other jealous at certain points. And again, very much a young love kind of experience, you know. It felt very authentic.
That's what I mean. When you were talking about Sean Penn, and it was really funny, because when you said you never seen him anything funny, of like, I've seen him in roles I found him funny, but I don't think...
I don't think it was meant to be.
You know, like, I'm always brought back to Tropic Thunder, I Am Sam. Like, oh, he went full retard. That was just not the way to go. He didn't get the Oscar. But also in Milk, like, I don't think he doesn't pull off camp very well. So I found it more comical than funny.
And he just... And maybe this is me being influenced by, like, media and stuff like that. He doesn't come across as a very pleasant individual, you know?
That's just his face, yeah. No,
But there's also been, like...
Because his brother has the same thing. His brother from, Reservoir Dogs? Yeah. Has that face that you're just like, you look pissed off about something.
That's true. Maybe it's just, you know...
To Sean, to Jason, I also have resting male bitch face, and it's okay. People always think I'm mad about something, and I'm not. I'm just usually looking at something.
But
Ed has a very kind face.
I do. Children point and laugh at me.
Well, my daughter does at least.
Just overall, the cast was brilliant. Felt again very authentic. I know this is a bit of a buzzword nowadays, but it just really felt like a guy who's telling a story that he kind of knows inside out.
Is this up there? The other one that's like this, I haven't watched, but obviously you mentioned it to PTA fans, and like, you'll do it in a minute. This collective noise goes over the room. Mm. Like, is this up there with Magnolia?
I kind of didn't like Magnolia.
Oh, he says it on the podcast.
Yeah, I know. That's one that I should rewatch.
Was that because of Tom Cruise?
I think so, because it was in that kind of time.
Yeah,
when he was just going off the rails.
Yeah, he is off the rails. I watched that documentary, but I watched it again about, you know, the German documentary on Scientology.
Yeah.
Do you know those people think they're better than everyone else?
Well,
No, I'm not kidding. Like, it's literally part of their religion. They think they're chosen and better than everyone. I'm not talking like Jewish chosen, because that's a different thing altogether.
Every time, like, when I find out someone's a Scientologist, I'm like, oh no.
It's this whole like, but you're special. I'm
so disappointed in you.
I know. See, and I don't say that to Christians, and that's when I, like, Christians don't appreciate that. Then I'm like, no, I didn't say, oh, it's so sad you're a Christian, you know? But, like, Scientology, sorry, that's not, like, I have, in my head, I guess I have probably like 12 religions that I've studied that I'm like, legitimate. Okay, like, if you want to believe those, there's enough evidence out there that I can say, fine, I can dig it.
You can live with it.
Scientology, the dude was a science fiction writer, guys.
I mean, again, I think that...
Science fiction writer, guys.
It's interesting.
Joked about how much money he would ever make if he ever wrote a science fiction religion.
And again, the master very clearly like...
I kind of just want to walk into Scientology with Dune and just be like, actually, you guys should be reading this instead.
Yeah, this would make a lot more sense. But...
How was Harry Conan?
What were we saying? What were we talking about?
I don't know. I got an idea. No, we were talking about... Well, first we were talking about Scientology.
And yes.
It's ridiculous. We were talking about like Magnolia.
That's right, Magnolia. So I think I need to rewatch it because there was also a lot of hype when that came out. And I think it was after Boogie Nights. I hadn't watched Boogie Nights yet.
Because that's the one. That's the one that people say, like, that's his best film.
I think it was... Because it's one of his... I actually like Hard Eight more than I like any of his other films.
I still haven't watched that. You always recommend that.
Because you'd love it, because you're a gambler as well. So, like... John C. Reilly is phenomenal.
Is there a guy that stands next to the gambler and sweats with all the money he's going? Because that's Ed and I going out like, don't do it, Jay. No, fuck it, we're riding on red, baby. We're riding on red.
I'd be like, what's going on? I don't understand. That was literally my frame of mind in the only casino I've ever been in. Put money into a machine,
so you want money disappears.
I don't know why. Magnolia is not my jam. I think for me, his best was There Will Be Blood. Because of what he did with the camera.
What did he do with the camera?
They just... Every shot, every... Like, the first... The opening, like, 5 minutes when he's in the well.
And he gets
hit on the head. Like, no dialogue. It was just... It was my filmmaker student day, you know? Exactly.
Show them, but don't tell them.
I think now, I would say this is his best.
Well, because the problem is you get out of film school, and then what happens with the show me, don't tell me thing is that some people turn to you and say, but I don't understand what's going on.
Yeah, I don't get what's happening. Yeah, exactly.
You didn't show me.
I think this is a beautiful balance of everything that he's good at in terms of crafting an amazing-looking film without being flashy. I don't think there's any moment that's overly like stylized.
It's very like you could watch Boogie Nights and see the exact same shots. Like he's not treading new territory here. He's sticking to his palette.
And I think he's almost paring it back a little bit. Because in Boogie Nights, I think one of the things that I noticed when I rewatched it is that he's just moving the camera all the time.
That is true. There's a lot of chop as well on that, isn't there? Yeah. Like if I remember, he cuts between scenes quite quickly.
But this is not overly flashy, and it's entertaining, and it feels good. Like it's for me, it's just the perfect balance of what I want from him as a filmmaker, and what I think an entertaining film should be like.
That's right. Because then we get to at least the end game for me, which is the production side of it. So why? Because this film is seeing a lot of good appeal in the world right now, which I'm very happy to hear. But why? Well, I think it's the right time for this film to come out as well. Like, it's not postmodern. It's romantic. And I think we are going to be moving, as hard times set in around the world, which they're going to, guys.
They are.
You don't have to believe me. But yeah. just watch the news and read the business papers. And hard times are upon us, folks. For however long they last. They always last for a couple of years and then go away again. But... during those times, first of all, that's why film always remains resilient. Because surprisingly, people will still show up to the movie theaters even in the worst economies.
And sometimes even more so when the economy starts going bad.
Exactly. It's why you can always. It's why the best can always get money.
There is definitely an element of escapism to go into the film.
Between superhero movies and this now, I definitely think we are on a trend now pushing us away from that postmodern feeling, saying, actually, wouldn't it be nice to have just a little bit of fantasy? And what you'll see... is you have films like this. Now, were there any elements of this film, because there were some in The Master, and I don't remember any from this film, that are magical realism. It's one of my favorite things, because a lot of South American and Spanish directors and writers like to use it. It's much more prominent in Spanish-speaking cultures, because there's a whole movement based on it. Like, I'm trying to think of the guy I used to read out of Colombia. What was his name? Gael García...
No, Gael García Bernal is the Mexican actor.
No. I'll remember it and get on the
Gabriel García Márquez?
Possibly a writer.
Yeah. I think that's right.
But what I was going to say is films and whatnot, they have this element of magical realism. What that is you'll get a scene that looks completely real, except it has one element of it like, that is mystical. Yeah, and you're like, how did that happen? Yeah. You know what I mean? And it's never explained, and that's the magical part of it. Yeah. It's like, it doesn't need to be explained. It's just part of the story. Yeah. I love stuff like that. And I think it will creep more into films now, because people will want that escape and want that, you know, the joy of the metaphorical joy of life.
Yeah.
But I didn't see any here yet.
No, and I think that that's a really, really good point. I think that's something that I picked up on whilst I was watching that I really appreciated. I appreciated how grounded it was.
That's right.
You know, and it never got like, you know, we often talk about stakes in movies and how high are the stakes, raise the stakes and these kinds of things. And this film did such a beautiful job of for these people, the stakes are very high. It's their heart, right?
It's their lives, yeah.
But it's not the end of the world. It's not about a mass murderer. It's not about... It doesn't go in any particular extreme. It just stays really, really grounded. And I like you, really like magical realism as well. I like it in films. But I think that in the right films, do you know what I mean?
It's just... There would have been opportunities to use it here, and I that's why what you're saying, like, I think I was surprised that it didn't, but then by the end of it, I was like, I understood why he wasn't using it.
Yeah.
Because this wasn't an Amol Dvar, and this wasn't this was supposed to be a very flat kind of progression. And it's like, well, you know, what we're combating here is loneliness, and we have loneliness from a 25-year-old girl who has problems with acceptance because she lives in this big family, and no one really gets... You know, she's very much remind me of 10 Things I Hate About You. That type of character. But then you also have this boy. And like, as I said, I was more interested in his character, to be honest, because...
He was so great.
I had to root for him.
His swag.
Yeah, like, exactly, because you didn't want to.
When he first meets her.
But then he has such confidence and such swag and such belief in himself that you're like, every person should be like this. So why do I care if he's 15 or 50? Like, you know, we should all be this confident about where we are.
Again, it's almost like a hero you really want to root for, right? Like he you want him to succeed.
Right,
you want
and as to work immature out. As he is, when he disagrees with her, like, that's love. Like, he doesn't yell at her. There's very few instances of them screaming at each other, which is where you see things start going wrong with relationships. Instead, like, he's very calm, and he will listen to her and say, you can think whatever you want, you know what I mean? Like, that's a sign, and that's another thing I really appreciated is PTA showing that kind of like, that is a healthy relationship. If he can sit there and be like, well, you can think what you want, I'm going to think what I want, but he doesn't go crazy about it. Like, that's another element of, wow, there is really
very grounded, very realistic.
Especially at 15, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And again, you can hear that age and be like, well, that's ridiculous. Like, but, you know, we've all been 15.
Watch the film. I think it is ridiculous if you don't watch the film. If you don't understand, that's like the first 10-minute setup that PTA does really well for that. And I think it had to be done very quickly like that. But he sets up this kid's life and just is like, well, he's not you, okay? Yeah. You want him to be a 15-year-old like you were,
right?
You know, struggling in high school mixers and stuff like that. Fuck no. This kid's been in like 4 shows. He runs this business. It's tough. You know, and he does his best.
But again, very, very realistic. Like, it never felt like...
That's very Hollywood realistic.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
That was one of the most interesting things about being out there and hearing stories about the people that, you know...
Grew up in that world.
The ones that make the headlines are always like the Millie Bobby Browns and stuff like that. But lots of people do that. They try to make a living. They pick up everything.
Yeah.
Move to California and say, I'm going to make it big here. And again, the things that will get like the East Coasters is that doesn't mean school. That means like, if I find a job that works, we're going to do it. You know what I mean? And I don't care if I go to school or graduate or anything like that.
Yeah.
Like, it just always...
It's very California, again.
It
like,
is.
And
it's
I've never been
different.
There. It
just it's
just
different.
Feels
it's really
way,
different.
You know?
There's no talk about university or, you know, you're going to finish your whatever, your GED or whatever. I liked all that because that's, again, we need more of that type of expression and thinking, I think, in the world as it gets a bit crazier and a little bit hairier for everyone else out there. So anyways, you know, we've rambled on about this particular show, I think, long enough, hopefully.
No.
No? What else do you...
We need to talk about music, dude.
Okay, so we're gonna finish up the show talking about Hunky Dory and all the other music. It was
Life on Mars is the
David Bowie. I was singing that in the cinema.
Everybody, and every time it comes on now, my daughter's like, "Is that from that movie, Dad?" I'm like, "It's not from that movie, but and it will remind you of that movie from now on." But what were some of the other songs that you really enjoyed from there? There are quite a few.
I mean, yeah, Life on Mars kind of stands out.
As a theme tune, yeah.
But honestly, like...
And if you listen to the lyrics of Life on Mars, parts of it make sense as to why he's chosen that.
Yeah. There's a lot of songs. I'm looking at the song list now, right? And the 70s is a musical period that I've never kind of really explored much.
Okay.
But it did such a great job of putting me in that time and place.
He seemed to be doing a bit of a Tarantino, and because Tarantino obviously is the master at doing that. No pun intended, PTA. But you know that is who's known for having his soundtracks ready to go. Edgar Wright being a close second. Yeah. That is another person who has always got his soundtracks right. And maybe that's why I wasn't as. It's not that I didn't like it. It's just exactly what I expected in a good way.
It fair enough.
Like,
yeah, yeah.
It did exactly what it meant. I went home being like, if I had any extra money, which I don't right now, if I had any extra money, I'll be buying the liquor. You know, once I get paid, which is in like 4 days, I'll be buying the Licorice Pizza soundtrack.
Because I wanted all my... I bought the Last Night in Soho one for the same reason.
Yeah,
because when you get a quality director who invests time in making the soundtrack like that...
And it's just so important.
It's so good because for me, like... I don't know. Anybody who hangs out with me knows that I listen to movie stuff in my car all day long.
Mm.
But listening to a soundtrack that's made this way will help me put back in the movie without having to watch the movie. For me, it's actually like a better way because the music will put me more in the scenes that I want. And then I can go on with the music. Like Last Night in Soho, you know, some of those are really short songs in the movie. But I love the songs. So they take me to the place and then I can kind of still remember the back. But I mean, right now, those are going up as like my two favorite films of the year. It's really weird because we're getting to the end here. We are at the end, you know, we're in 2022, and it's like, what did you love from last year? And it's like, well, you know, Last Night in Soho came out at the end being kind of my favorite because I'd seen so many blockbusters, but that one really stands out in my head.
Mm.
And then this one, because it just, I have never laughed, smiled. Part of the other thing I didn't mention, and it's because we're talking about so many different things, I was really... vocal in the theater for this one. And Ed's been with me before and knows I can be vocal. Horror movies, I'm usually quite vocal. You know what I mean? I will be like, don't do that or do that. This one, like, I was laughing. Yeah. I was commenting. Yeah. I was like, you know, sucks if you had to sit next to me. But do you know what I mean? I was really into this one while it was going on. And the other thing I noticed, and I told Ed this on the phone, which this was the first time I'd seen this at the Cineworld I was at, is the rest of the audience was too.
Mm.
The dude next to me was laughing.
Was it?
It was a mix. So there was like, there were definitely a bunch of film students in there, which you would expect.
PTA,
like, you know,
yeah.
PTA. But then you had a bunch of older people, you know, dads and moms. And
that
then,
makes sense.
Then even older than that. And I had some, you know, some you know, geriatrics in there, which is fine. You know what I mean? It's just, I was surprised because I was like, are they going to like? But then everybody was responding quite positively to the film.
And I think that this is where I think that he's hit the nail on the head in terms of this has a serious, very wide appeal.
It does. In a weird way, it does. I think so much more than Boogie Nights did, because Boogie Nights was the last one that had this universal appeal that a lot of people really liked. You know,
and Boogie Nights, again, it gets dark. It gets very dark.
Well, and for me personally, and this is, you know, telling a little bit about my past life, not that I've been in porn, but I do know people in porn, and like... I felt like it was sensationalizing the whole thing.
Right. And that,
which sounds ridiculous. No, I know you're going to be like, fuck you, Jason, are you serious? You're saying that you felt porn and making the quotes that you're going to make is sensationalized. Like, yes. Like, everyone was so surprised. It's like, why are you surprised? This happens in the Valley in California every fucking
day.
But
I think that was kind of the point with Boogie Nights. I think he was trying to make a statement as a filmmaker.
Possibly,
you know,
yeah.
And be a bit controversial. And
I felt like it went to Dave Chappelle, though, that he made the statement and people completely missed the point.
I think so. I think it's just, you know, I saw a really funny meme of, like, if you're idolizing these guys, you miss the point. And it's like a picture of Rick from Rick and Morty. It's like Walter White from Breaking Bad. And it's true. It's like, you're like, yes, so many people just love these characters, including your guy from Mad Men as well, who are like...
With the Dom Drapers.
Yeah. Like, just pretty terrible human beings, right?
But exactly what you're saying. The problem is We as people, and I'm not yelling at you, but we as people have to put them on one or the other. Like, one of the things I'm always trying to get out to people, what is my mantra, which is my story to people, is the gray area in life. There are no monsters.
No, there are no heroes. Right.
That's what those types of characters are trying to show you, that even great men, great people are horribly flawed.
And I like that as a message. I do. And I recognize that as the deeper message.
But what happens, unfortunately, is people grab onto these things and then don't, you know, don't talk to an American that way. God, my whole country's built on showing half the story of things.
Right.
And it's like, come on, guys. Like, and there's the problem I have, and this is more railing against Americans than English people, but it's a universal problem, is like this need to have the black and white, the need to have the hero and the villain. Like, can you not just accept, as an intelligent person who understands the way the world works, that people are going to do good things and people are going to do bad things, and there's not always a connection between all of that and who they are as a person? That's coming from a lawyer, and I'm sorry, but that's probably the truest thing I've ever said on this podcast, because it's like, people run themselves in circles over that shit.
But my point being that I think with Boogie Nights, a lot of people... Oh, it's about porn, and do you know
that's what I mean. Like, they were all that. It's the same thing. Like, because there's so few movies ever made about porn, you know, wonder why. But then a later movie tried to do a similar message, and it was, I'm surprised people didn't go to see it because they loved Boogie Nights, but they didn't love this. It was about Rebecca Loveless, and that was a half movie. So you saw half the movie where she looks like the most intersex person you've ever met, that just absolutely loves whatever's in front of her. And then you find out it was nothing like that, and that she was abused, and that she was put into these situations. And I think people had found the second half obviously really hard to swallow, being like, oh, that's why most people who watch porn don't watch like behind the scenes stuff, because you wouldn't watch porn if
the making of.
And you're like, oh, that's pretty terrible, you know? That's my point. Boogie Nights, it got sensationalized, and I'm like, for a guy like PTA, like, why would you want anything sensationalized? He's the least sensationalized guys I can think of.
Yeah, I think there maybe, and I'm just guessing here, but there is a calculation sometimes of, oh, this will be controversial, people will talk about this.
And, yeah, it was definitely a talking point, yeah.
But
and it's fine. I mean, he got an Oscar for that one, didn't he?
Like, he's did always... Did he win or was he nominated? I think he was... his first Oscar may have been for There Will Be Blood.
Okay.
But he's always been, he's always been kind of in the conversation.
Part of my dislike for that movie also, a lot of that can be down to PTA's casting choices. I'm not a Julianne Moore fan. Like,
Fair enough.
I just haven't. I don't think she's a very good actress.
Okay.
I didn't think she was in that film.
Okay.
I just think she was supposed to be this like motherly porn star, and you're like, no, they don't. No, there's no motherly porn stars. I'm sorry. Like, maybe there are now that an incest porn is, you know, taken off from wherever that came from. But no, like, from porn stars I knew, like, there was never, there was like, oh, what's up, little boy? Like, no, it's kind of gross. So I don't know. You know what I mean? Like, there were just so many elements of, like, did he spend any time with actual porn stars? Like,
well, again, like, he, you know, he lived in, where he's from.
Is he from Encino or is he from Valley?
He's from... I'm not, I think
you don't know, because you don't know LA.
No.
So most porn's filmed in the Valley.
In the Valley, right. But I think that's where he lived for a long time, like, as a young man.
You know? So that would explain, because what would happen when you live in the Valley, what happens is funny, is like, and I never lived there, but I had friends who did. And what you do is you go look around somebody's backyard, and it's like, hey, can we come over? Make sure you bring a rubber.
But again, I feel like this just felt more mature. I liked the argument that they have when she's asked, like, are you willing to do nudity and stuff like that? And then he gets all defensive and shit like that. And
it's the only time they argue. It's the only real time
but
he gets
mad.
He's
like, but you're my friend. You're my friend. He keeps saying that. But yeah, this just felt like very grown up in a way, like somebody looking back on like their youth and when they fell in love and stuff like that, you know?
Yeah, that's the thing. The only thing about PTA that hasn't worked for me so far that we've been talking about, except for this film, is he doesn't let his guard down. Like, he's a very precise
clinical
director.
Yeah.
And he will let you see what he wants you to see, but he won't. There's all the, you know, it's my brain, dude. Like, there's other stuff there. This one, it was clear that he was just taking the barriers down just to be like, okay.
Yeah, I could see
maybe
that.
Maybe I'll just enjoy the film.
I gotta say, probably I mean,
and I think that comes from the director's struggle. This is where Joss Whedon, we always feel for him on Ultron.
Have you also been reading about that?
No, I haven't. We'll get to that in just a second. But like, there is, and I haven't really gone through that as much because I haven't directed many things. But there's the director's struggle that you have your vision that you want for the screen, and it may or may not get there. But some directors get so stuck in their head that it comes out a little bit shittier because they're so confused about what they want to try to say, and it's like, I think that happens. Like, I think he focuses so hard on getting it right that it doesn't. This one, it just looked like he just relaxed just a little bit to say, it's okay, dude.
He's got his craft down, and now it's about...
It's why I use Age of Ultron, because what happened there, I'm fairly certain, because I've seen that in my day job where I have projects I have to manage that are monstrous of that, not of that size, but, you know, monstrous. And what happens is certain people just shut down because it's too much. Like... And maybe it was, you know what I mean, for Josh in that one. And so the vision of what he wants to do never comes out on the screen because he's too worried about pissing off the people in front of him, you know, the producers and things like that. Mm. So we've definitely had kind of the other directors before. We've had other directors that are like, well, you need to cut this down here. No, I will not do that. What are you on your mind? Like, that one is much more common.
Yeah.
But the director in his own head, like PTA, I would definitely say has done that on some of his films. And. Mm. And otherwise, but tell me what, you know, before we end this thing, what happened to Josh? What is he? He's directing Euphoria now, right?
I'm not too sure. All I know is that he kind of responded to the comments that were made about his treatment of particularly the guy who played Cyborg in...
That's the one that's been the most vocal. Is that Ray?
Yeah,
Ray
something. But apparently he responded, and it's just not a good look. And
why? How did he respond? Is this another one where I'm going to have to hate him like I hate Mel Gibson now?
I mean, not to that degree.
I mean, he sucks. I watch Mel Gibson. Mm. I tried to watch Braveheart, and like, I am Scottish, so I love that film. And I had to like stop watching it and be like, okay.
I don't know. It's the kind of stuff that I tend to...
No, we're really just playing anyway. Listen, I can watch a Mel Gibson film because, you know, this is exactly what I was talking about with Grey Area. Like, listen, I like his films. Shit, I don't think he'd ever like to meet me then if he disliked people of dark skin color that much. Maybe he liked the fact that I was Scottish. But, you know, but is he the first guy that I've met from Australia that talks like that? Like, no. No, not in the slightest. Like, and that's okay. Like, that's fine. Is it the same? Is it the first person that comes from where I come from that talk like that? Mm. I think that's what gets some people. They're always like, yeah, I grew up with racists, mate. Like, they're my friends, you know? I know that sounds stupid to you.
My friends' fathers. And yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's the way it is. And so that's what I mean. Like, I'll have to read about the Josh and we can talk about it next time. But
a couple of things that I wanted to mention before we sign off.
Okay.
Because I forgot to mention them in the What Did We Watch This Week. But... I caught up with Boba Fett at your place while I was dog sitting.
I know, he was the nicest. We had like this most amazing family weekend ever, and it was all because Ed decided to have a sleepover with Boo at my house.
But I caught up with Book of Boba.
Is that you who fell asleep with Shang-Chi then as well?
Yes.
Oh, okay, phew.
Sorry.
Phew! Yeah, I thought somebody stole my account. I was like, what? Who's been watching Shang-Chi?
It's getting better. But the one thing that really bugs me, and the reason why I remembered it, is because we were talking about music. The music is really not very good.
Did I get Ludwig Göransson back for it?
He's credited, but I don't. He's not. He doesn't score it.
I love it because we love this guy, and we've seen so many films now. Like his name pops up, and I always just smile in your ear because he's such a thoughtful musician.
He's
like he
so good.
He gets into the core of like what he's making. It could have been though. I mean, the Eternals, right? Like I'm watching that. That's what I've been watching this week as well. I'm watching it in parts with my daughter because she wanted to start watching Marvel.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know why I put her on that one first, but I'm really glad I did because she really likes it. Like, it's a really good one for her. But that's the one done by the guy who did Game of Thrones, and the music is ultimately very forgettable.
Yeah,
like, it has a theme.
Yeah,
he
definitely
came up with a theme. It's just the theme sounds very, like, morning show. This week on Tech Talk.
Right.
You know, like, I don't know. That's the best way I can describe it. I'm a musician. That's what I'm trying to tell you from another musician how it sounds to me. It sounds very plain. And I don't know why you didn't make it, like... The reason it works in Game of Thrones is because like I can even make movements to it, the way it sounded to me, the way you could hear them playing the drums and stuff like it's very kinetic. Like
contemporary dance moves to it.
I do at night before I start writing. Yeah.
This is
the funniest thing about me, Ed, that I'm just putting it on the podcast just to see if anybody takes it up on this. But listen, like I have no curtains on my house, and I live in the middle of nowhere. So
I did notice that
at 12 o'clock at night, I will do whatever the fuck I want in my kitchen, and God forbid someone figure out that all I got to do is point a camera or just go up to my window and look, and you'll see me doing wow, whatever you want to see. You know what I mean? Like, cracks me up because I'm always like, oh, no one's watching.
The other thing that I wanted to mention, and I think maybe we want to talk about this because it changes a lot about what we discussed about The Matrix. Because I don't know how true this is. I read this somewhere and watched a couple of videos and stuff. But apparently the reason why Lana Wachowski did the film and the reason why her sister didn't is because they were going to make the movie with or without them. Like the studio.
No, you're exactly right. Thank you. Mm. Because this is going back to things I've read. Yes, that was exactly the issue. And then the second would it's because it was Barry and
is it like Kira or something like that?
It's Kira's the other one. Yes, yeah. Lana and Kira. Yeah. And sorry, I just, you know, I knew you guys when you guys were dudes, you know what I mean? And now you're very lovely ladies. But yeah, that was the big reason. I don't understand. Did it go into detail about the second Wachowski though?
It didn't really talk about why, but I think they were both saying no for a really long time. And then the studio said, well, fine, if you guys aren't going to do it...
We're going to option some writers and we're going to put it out there. Yeah, no, I do remember reading that. So that does kind of... It doesn't horribly change the perspective because I still think at the end, Lana still pushed through a lot of her message about Trinity and what she wanted with that.
Yeah, I think so
and
too.
Maybe that was the compromise. Maybe it was like, you're going to make something.
But it suddenly made a lot more sense. Her, like, the constant jabs at, like... industry people and, you know, people giving notes. I see
what you're saying. So what if you take that as her commentary to the studio within the film, saying, like, this is what you all look like.
Mm. And I still don't necessarily agree with it because, I mean, a film kind of making fun of itself, it's not the first time that it's ever happened, but... I just...
It's tough because he's sitting next to his producer. That's tough because that's a slap at your producer. It's like, fuck you.
I mean, yeah.
And I don't agree with that. You know that because we've sat around artists that have that mentality of being like, well, this is what I want to do, so fuck you, Mr. Producer. Like, listen, and I'm going to say it in the shittiest tone I can. Like, the producer's not there to help you with it, the film doesn't get fucking made.
Yeah.
Okay? And trust me, the reason I'm so angry about that is because... we get questions about that 9 times out of 10. It's like, well, why haven't you done this? And why haven't we done this? Like, guys, if you don't show up to make the fucking film, then we don't have a film, guys. Like, that's how it is. I can get the concept together. I can tell you what needs to be put together. Sorry, this is me really going off. But, like, I can tell you all the mechanics for getting it together and be there for you to help you with it. But if you don't make the fucking film, then it doesn't get made. You know what I mean? Like, you have to pick up the camera. You have to do it. And so that's why I would be pissed off at anybody who's like, taking jokes at the suggestions that the execs are making. Like, they just want your film to sell, you know, so that you can make another one. Mm. Like, for them, it's business. It's their jobs. Mm. And I guess that's the thing that I get pissed off, because I have a job that I work really hard at during the day, and it's like, that seems at times similar, and it's like, you know, I don't do that because I have this overt love for everything. I do that job because it pays my bills, and because I gotta put bread on the table, so I have to be very practical. Film's the same way, guys. Like, at least if you want that kind of film money.
Yeah. The only thing is that if you take your producer hat off, no, I'm just touching you because I love you.
No, that's okay.
Not because you're knocking the table. If you take your producer hat off and put your, like, writer-director hat on, I think you might sympathize a little bit more with Lana in terms of, like, feeling like someone's taking something that's yours away from you. That doesn't make it right.
No, but I know what you mean. But, I know exactly what you mean.
But it's an interesting point of view. And I think it made me think of Planet of the Apes, the Tim Burton Planet of the Apes.
Why?
were completely going to blow past my comment.
I was, but now you've mentioned a film that I love. And I want to know why.
Because...
No one's ever fucking seen that film.
When that came out, it got quite heavily panned.
Oh, heavily panned.
And
I worked in a movie store when it came out.
He was asked, like, why did you do it like this? This doesn't seem like you. And his answer, and I'm probably putting words in his mouth, but this is what I remember it being. He said, somebody was going to make a new Planet of the Apes film. And I wanted to be the person to do it, even if it was a terrible film. That's kind of what he said.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, that was, when I read that, it felt very poignant to me.
Did you watch that one?
I really enjoyed it, yeah.
It was missing a lot. I mean, that was when he went into the details of what he was talking about with that. I mean, they cut... It was a very complicated story to begin with, but they cut a lot. It needed... Okay, so Highlander 2 is a really good example of a movie like that. That was shit when it came out. Then the Renegade cut came out, which was when the director added back in all these scenes for some reason. You're talking to me. So some reason they cut out for time.
Yeah.
You know, because they thought it was the 80s. And it was like, we'll just make it like this. Boom, boom, snappy. You know, action movies in the 80s. This was one that actually needed those extra parts. So when you watched it with the extra parts put in, it was a really good movie. When you watched it without, it was horribly convoluted and hard to understand. Planet of the Apes being the same way. There was this whole death comeback, and the time bit was the part, because they do this double time thing where you're back in time and then you go back in time again. And it was a really good concept, but he needed like four more scenes to explain to you what was going on. And you only get images. You get like an images of the monkey and the thing, and it's like, that's actually what's happened. And that's why it panned. Yeah. I quite liked the film as well, though, Ed. Like, it came out when I was working in a movie store. I love Tim Burton. You know what I mean? I didn't think it was bad. I definitely think, like you said, it was, you know, what I would say in the relation to The Matrix, what surprises me then is that, you know, and I don't know how you do this, but like it's like Alien 3 was another one. Like, you either go against your production company and speak your mind as the artist then, if you really believe that, or you do what you're supposed to do. And this is what you're supposed to do. And this is not because the producer's a dick. It's because he's trying to make you money.
Be a team player.
You be a team player. Yeah. And you sit on there. One or the other. And I know I just spent hours talking about gray area, right? But this is not one of those things. Gray area would do nothing but just shoot you both ways. You're either going to slowly slump on sales, or you're going to, you know what I mean? So if Lana wants that, then she needs to come out and say, this is why I did this, and this is why I did it, because I didn't agree with
it. One of my favorite things that I ever read in relation to like filmmaking and stuff like that was, nobody sets out to make a bad movie.
No!
You know, everyone...
That's why that guy, Uwe Boll, is starting fights with people, because he's like, I don't make bad movies. Like, well, you do, but I don't think you mean to.
Yeah, yeah. And it was like...
Who's that? It was Harlan Davis that made Cutthroat Island, and like people just...
Oh, yeah.
That's just like hailed his career. Hailed is like one of the worst films of all time. It's like, well...
I never saw it. Did you see it?
I mean, it's bad, but it's not like the worst film I've ever seen. We saw Los Manos. You know, that was...
Los Manos was easily the worst
film I'd ever seen, you know?
Yeah. Oh, that was so bad. But, you know, even The Room, even Ed Wood, Plan 9 from Outer Space, like, people are trying to make art. And I know that it sounds so corny and so, you know, whatever, but it's a form of expression.
Well, it just works both ways. The other thing that I think sometimes coming from the producer side, you know, that artists and directors and writers need to respect sometimes, and it's hard these days because we do have, as I said, black and white and Twitter wars about everything, is that sometimes people aren't going to like your art.
100%.
The arguments I've actually had as a producer, those are those arguments. They just don't like it. We need to cut this because it's not as funny as you think it is.
The thing is that filmmaking is very much a team sport. And I think, I'm guessing here, I don't have any statistics to back this up, but I think that more films have been improved by the contributions of editors, of producers, of, you know, music score writers, of just all the hundreds and thousands of people that you see, you know, like flash up at the end of a movie. Like, they're all trying to make the best thing they can.
Absolutely.
And, you know, that's something that I always try and remember. Like, you know, if someone gives me a note that I don't agree with, I'm like, I try to tell myself, look, this person's trying to help you.
Yeah, well, listen, like, some things I can say about this, and this is, you know, having done project management my day job, and I do less of that now, but in a creative space, feedback is essential. like essential. It's something I just had this conversation with Ed because I said I'm gonna need more writers because I need more feedback. Because when you're writing, like, it has to come constantly and it has to come frequently because that's part of the process. And you can't be that person on the other side of the table that can't stand that someone doesn't like your shit. If you like it that good, it's got to be written better. You know what I mean? Like, that's the bottom line, because everybody in the room, you know you've got it when everybody in the room all of a sudden says, yeah, that's it. Do you know what I mean? It's not a one-person thing. And the worst thing sometimes dealing with indie level, you know, when we're talking about people starting out, people that have been doing this for a couple of years and get it, is that stubbornness to understand that, you know, negative criticism is part of the job.
People are very precious.
You know what I mean? Like, your idea has to be molded into something that everyone wants to see.
Forged, right?
Exactly. Like, never starts. You know, that's coming from a guy. I didn't listen to my podcast last year because I'm going through this as a writer right now, where last year everything smelled so good and I was so great with everything. And now I'm like, it all sucks. I've got to keep rewriting it. But that's the process. That's exactly what happens. And I don't just rewrite it based on what I think is better. I get notes from people and use those. I don't use everybody's notes, but that's the point. You've got to have that input to see the different angles that you could be taking with the story and the way it could go. Because eventually it will get there. Like, it's the best feeling, the best part about the writing. And then the directing is very similar. Like, you will get there. Even editing, you know. And I don't have as much experience with that with editing because it's such a long process. But the thought process is still the same. You're going to start with something that doesn't look quite right. You're going to get it to a point that you're
chip
happy
away.
With.
Chip you know? Away.
As I said, I shouldn't say I've never done that. As I said, when I did Dandelions, that's why I was so proud of that. Because it was chipping away at it slowly, surely, story-wise first, then when we made it, and then when we edited it. Every single part of that process was iterating it another time. And it still came out, well, I'm always proud of that last shot. The rest of it, I'm like, well, my daughter did a good job. But that's my point. Like, it didn't start that way. It wasn't, that was certainly not originally how I wrote it. That was certainly not originally how we shot it. And that was certainly not how I edited it. And that's what I mean. You've got to be able to go in there and change it up. So that's the only thing I'd say with Lana. Like, if that really was her view, like, if she had just put a press something out there, then it would have made perfect sense to me. I still think, and I still agree with my comments before, that it's still an old person trying to comment about young people.
I think there is definitely an element of that. Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah. I'm sorry, but it just sounded like someone who didn't actually play a lot of video games trying to comment about video games.
Yeah. But that's all I've got to say about that.
Was that an attempt? Bubba Gum Shrimp this weekend. It was really fun. I was talking about Waffle Boy, which is this new, I was going to recommend it to you when you stayed over at my house. There's a new delivery by my place, and Becky came home, you know, earlier in the week, and
I had a cheesesteak.
Nice.
It was so good.
Well, I wanted to get takeaway, but, you know, I was like, I don't want to think about it. So it's either Domino's or you know, I tried this new place called Waffle Boy. And then, you know, Becky, of course, and wives always ask you these types of questions. Like, well, what do they serve there? And I was like, well, it's called Waffle Boy. So it's kind of like everything with waffles. But what kind of waffles? I'm like, waffles and chicken, waffles and eggs, waffles and blah, blah. She's like, shrimp. I'm like, yes, okay. Sounds just like that. She's like, it's all about waffles. And don't believe it when they say savory. Everything's really sweet because it's waffles.
Did you see that there was a really funny mock-up poster? Instead of the Book of Boba Fett, it was the Book of Bubba Fett. And it was like Bubba and Forrest, like on the
best. Tuck that thing in, get it, Cardinal. Tomorrow, son. You two of relation? No, sir, we are not of relation. I love that movie. I might have to watch that movie again.
That's a great film.
All right, folks. Well, we are coming to the end of this. Next week, we may do Teddy. If I don't find another film to put in there, I'm going to see.
I'm
going to
try and watch Tick, Tick, Boom this week. I don't know if that's one
that will
you
easily
want to.
Take place. If you're like, that film was awesome, I was like, yes, because it talks about the creative process. And so I think that would be a good one. Especially
it's getting some Oscar buzz as well.
People are in writing mode. Yeah, this is the thing. So I went through most of these films. So Don't Look Up, Being the Ricardos, this film that we're talking about, Licorice Pizza, Tick, Tick, Boom. Like, the whole reason is that I read one of those lists that was printed because none of the papers like making anything near Christmas. So they all do top 20 lists. And this was on the Oscar bait you may want to catch. And it's always, for me, it's always may want to, because some years I can't stand Oscar bait. And
there was that one year, I think it was like 2018 or something, maybe when we started the podcast, where Jojo Rabbit came out and stuff.
Yes.
That was a really good year.
That year we did Jojo Rabbit, and we never did the podcast on Marriage Story, but that was like,
that's right.
That was like my reaffirmation with Scarlett Johansson, because she's in both those films. And I was like, wow, that woman is one of the best actors out there. Absolutely amazing.
She's very good.
And then, like, what was it? 4 weeks ago, I watched her in Lost in Translation. Oh, my God! Scarlett, when are we going
to
hang?
I still need to watch Ghost in the Shell. I keep getting told.
It is worth watching. It is worth watching. Guys, I know you love the original anime. Ed will tell you, come to my house. Like, I love anime. But the Ghost in the Shell that she...
Clearly did... not if you haven't got through Arcane. I'm just kidding. You're going to end up not liking it just because I won't shut up
about
it.
Just to spite you. Just to spite you. No, go watch the new Ghost in the Shell. It was good. It's just different from, obviously, from the anime. So, you get it there. But anyways, next week we will, I imagine we'll be doing Tick, Tick, Boom. But we might do Teddy if he doesn't like Tick, Tick, Boom or doesn't want to do the thing on it. So, we'll catch you then, folks. Thank you so much for listening to the bit of the ramble of PTA. One you can catch, learn a lot about film, and enjoy it.
In theaters now.
But her friend is nowhere to be seen. Now she walks through her sunken dream. To the seat with the clearest view, and she's hooked to the silver screen. But the film is a sad thing.